Begin the day with a friendly voice, a companion, unobtrusive. Plays that song that's so elusive, and the magic music makes your morning mood. As we start episode 119 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, we want to send our thoughts out to everyone who's a fan of Neil Peart and Rush. And we're thinking of you guys because we lost Neil Peart this week, Barry. And wow, he's been such a part of this show. And every single week when people listen to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, you know, Neil Peart plays a part of our show.
Yeah, it does. And it's, you know, it was weird because we were actually recording a segment for the show when the news was announced. And when we stopped recording, you and I discussed it, and it was, it's heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking, I guess, for several different reasons. One, he was obviously suffering. He died of brain cancer, which apparently he had for a couple of years. And that's just got to be just such a horrible way to go. And he wasn't an older guy. You know, I believe he was, 67, Jeff?
When he died. 68, something like that.
So I say this, and I'm going to reference this line once again. I've said this at least a dozen times, if not three dozen times. If you have a chance to see your heroes or meet your heroes in some form, don't fuck around. Go out and do it. Make the effort. Get off the couch, spend the money, whatever it takes, because I had the opportunity to see Rush live probably a dozen times, and I never jumped on it, Jeff. And you know why? Because every year, I said to myself, they tour almost every year. I'll catch them on the next go around, whatever it was. And I kept putting it off. And then, of course, he retired from the band some 4 to 5 years ago. And I was always hopeful he was going to come back. And yes, hopefully I would have gone then, but I never did. And I could sit here now and I could run straight into the wall head first, as a form of penance for that, because I wasn't practicing what I was actually preaching. And I'm fucked up and devastated by it. I love Rush. I think he is maybe arguably the greatest drummer that I have ever heard, by far. And I never went and saw him live. And I, you know, it completely sucks. So I've said it. I'll say it again. I'm going to say it later in this episode. But it really does suck, Jeff. But you did get to see Rush live, right?
Yeah, I was real lucky. About 10 years ago, our friends Amanda and Will May had told us that they had, they were fans of Rush, had never seen him. I had never seen him. My wife had never seen him. They said, let's go. So we went and saw him at the BBT Arena in Fort Lauderdale, and I was completely blown away, I've become much more, I'll be honest, I'm much more of a Rush fan now than I was, 10, 15 years ago. I mean, I knew their songs and stuff like that, but I really became much more interested in the band over the last 10 years after I saw them in concert. And, the stuff with the washing machines on stage and the chickens roasting, I just thought was such kind of an interesting a gimmick for them. But the music live was just amazing, because their artistry was just so incredible. So anyway, we wanted to mention Neil because he was such an important, in my mind, such an important part of our show. Because last week, we discussed that, my choices for the song that was going to be the intro song for this show, two of them were Rush songs. It was either going to be Spirit of Radio or Tom Sawyer or two other songs. And so, it just shows that to me, Tom Sawyer has such an important part in wrestling history, because that was Kerry Von Erich's, walk-up song. And so I always associate Rush with wrestling because of that. So anyway, welcome to episode 119 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. I'm your host, Jeff Bowden. With me is my man, Barry Rose. And so before we get started, and I can tell you that today we're going to have part two of the Jimmy Garvin interview, which is absolutely fantastic. We're going to look at another match from World Class that has Terry Gordy and Jimmy Garvin taking on David and Kevin Von Erich from August 15th of 1983. And it is absolutely electric. And then we're going to discuss something that I don't know that we've ever discussed on this show before, Barry. I posted a link to an article that I'd seen involving a judge that got into a little hot water. I believe it was in Kentucky. The state judicial qualifying committee takes a dim view of judges that want to have threesomes in the courthouse.
Oh, that's, I mean, and that's so terrible.
So I believe it was Bruce Cohen who commented on it and said, hey, do you got any good sex stories from the courthouse? Well, let's just say Mr. Bowdren did a little bit of investigative journalism, reached out to a few friends of mine that had worked at the courthouse with me, and I got some stories. So after a very downbeat opening, we're going to have a pretty funny ending to the show, as I'm going to regale you guys with some sex stories from the old Broward County Courthouse. It's quite the den of iniquity. And so anyway, but before we get there, we wanted to mention Neil. We also, unfortunately, had a couple other deaths that we wanted to mention that were specifically wrestling related. And we're going to talk about each guy because two of the three guys had a direct connection with Florida and CWF, which, of course, Barry is, you know, the preeminent historian or archivist, as he likes to say. So we're going to discuss Kendo Nagasaki, Charlie Cook, and Pampero Firpo. Barry, first of all, let's talk about the Black Ninja, Kendo Nagasaki.
Yeah, and we should also say we're also going to throw La Parca.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're correct.
Yeah. Yeah. That. Four deaths within a week, which is devastating. So the Black Ninja, Kendo Nagasaki. So when I mentioned this during the opening, but our friend Eric Chulminski was in Japan. I think he's been home for about a week, but actually got to meet Kendo Nagasaki while he was over there. And he messaged me last night. It was about 9:30 at night and said, you know, you're absolutely right. And you say it on the podcast, but if you ever have the chance to meet your heroes, fucking do it. Because I always wanted to meet Kendo Nagasaki and I met him a week ago. And had I not been in Japan or had I not paid or stood in line, whatever it was, I wouldn't have been able to meet the guy because he's gone. So, his importance in wrestling, his importance in Florida is actually huge. One of the few guys that worked under three different gimmicks in Florida, and I don't think anybody, you know, unless you were reading The Observer or something, I don't think the average fan realized that it was the same guy. So he showed up in 1979 with Masao Tiger Hattori as his manager in Mr. Hito. And I believe they had been a tag team in the Stampede area, but it was Mr. Hito, Mr. Sakurada. They were the Florida Tag Team Champions. They had a great feud with Mike Graham and Ray Stevens, which is an odd pairing right there. He left, came back a couple of years later wearing a mask as Chan Chung. This gimmick did not really go over too well or fly, and that lasted only a few months. He was gone. But then within a year or two came back as we know him as Kendo Nagasaki. And really, you know, from that stage on, he got a push that was absolutely huge. And there was a lot of discussion, I guess, regarding his career in the beginning, because some people felt he was, quote unquote, a ripoff of the great Kabuki, because there was a lot of similarities there. But he kind of took this gimmick, made it his own, and in some ways became bigger than Kabuki, at least in the state of Florida and possibly the territories that he was working. I think he was doing more with it and aligned himself with J.J. Dillon. But we saw him in and out of Florida for give or take 4 to 5 years, and also aligned himself in 86 with the Ninja, the White Ninja, who was Kijimuto, the great Muda. I believe this was the first territory he ever worked in the U.S., Florida. And he was great right off the bat. But Kendo Nagasaki was a guy also was at a fan fest in Charlotte this past summer. And it's one of the didn't make a lot of shows here. And we were actually going to try to craft something where we could bring him down to Florida and build a fan fest around him because, it, you know, fuck, it was Kendo Nagasaki. But it didn't pan out, didn't work out. And I was real sad to wake up. You know, it's the worst thing when you wake up first thing in the morning and there's a text on your phone and it's, you know, somebody that you've admired is dead. It's like, really, that's how I'm starting my day. And it sucks. Kendo was respected by all and liked by all. So rest in peace. You know, it's a loss. And a young guy at 71 years old, Jeff, as you and I start to approach, you know, our late teens and, you know, our 30s, it's very difficult for us.
Yeah.
But, you know, here's a guy and apparently he died. It's quote unquote. And this, I guess, is translated from Japan, so I don't fully understand it, but his pacemaker slipped. So it's some sort of pacemaker malfunction that caused his death, which is just terrible to hear.
Yeah, and I like you, I saw the pictures that Eric posted of his trip to Japan, and he was at some sort of fan fest before the Tokyo Dome shows, and he was in full gimmick as Kendo Nagasaki. His real name, shoot name, is Kazuo Sakuruda.
Yeah.
Okay. And I just wanted to mention that. And of course, I remember him. I believe it was, let's see, about 1982 when they did the angle with him and yep. Mike Graham.
Yeah. And it really, it started off with he and Eddie. And it was hardcore at the time because Eddie got stretchered out and Eddie was pretty much retired at that point. You know, I think he'd had one match in like 2 years and he was done. So it was a big deal. And like I say, he got a push. There are a few heels in the 80s that came in, and I'll name three or four. The aforementioned that we talk about all the time, David Von Erich, got a big push. But Kendo was a creation of The Office. So he came in and they just, you know, shot out of a cannon. This was like an overnight deal. This was the most dangerous man in wrestling, literally overnight. So, yeah, a really, really big deal.
And the story that I always heard was that as far as coming up with his look, was it Terry or Dory Funk that decided he should have the middle of his scalp shaved?
I think it was Dory, if I'm correct. I believe Dory was booking at that point.
Yeah. So second name we want to mention again that has a connection with Florida is Charlie Cook. Charlie Cook, a guy that had, you know, he was always said to have played for the Pittsburgh Steelers. I think he was on what they called the taxi squad back in the day, but came out of Grambling same time as I think Ernie Ladd and Buck Buchanan, who was a NFL Hall of Famer, and sort of hung around, I don't want to say on the fringe of wrestling. He was never pushed as any sort of main eventer. And then Dory Funk brought him in about 1981 and pushed him real hard using his athletic background and the fact he was a former NFL player. He got the Florida title and had quite the push, didn't he, Bear?
He did too. And I'll tell you, so this is something too, and I always like having this discussion, but Charlie was a guy, he actually started working independents and was working independents in Florida going back to the early 70s and showed up for the first time in 1977 in CWF. State was working prelims. His finishing hold was, I believe, called the Bear Trap, which was kind of like a version of the Indian Deathlock. And it was very unique. I thought it was a pretty cool maneuver, pretty cool finisher. But he was, you know, second, third, fourth match of the night. Really never the curtain jerker. Wasn't getting, you know, above the fourth match, but a solid worker. And, you know, he did his job and brought him back in 81. And Dory Funk Jr. An odd booker at times because it was an odd decision in some ways. But it worked. You know, there was criticism that I've read. And I know Ric Flair criticized Charlie Cook in his book about, you know, that he wasn't worthy, I guess, of an NWA World's title.
Also quoted as saying that he was not a guy that it was easy to have a long match with.
Right. Which may be accurate that I don't know. But, you know, Charlie was over there. You know, there was a group of smart fans that never viewed Charlie, which you could see online at times. Howard Baum, I'm calling you out, sir. but I also get that because my own opinion of it is I think Charlie was maybe put in a position that may have been too great for him to carry. And I think had he been a little lower on the card and not in that position, I don't think people would have viewed him that way. I will say with his passing, the amount of respect from professional wrestlers that commented, and there were two things, a pleasure to work with every time and a finer human being you would never meet. And that was Jerry Briscoe and actually a slew of guys chimed in on the CWF Facebook group, basically saying that about Charlie. So I can tell you, I met him a bunch of times. He was a tremendous person, very low key, very reserved, very, very ethical. You know, he was just a stand-up guy and not a real outgoing guy. He was a family man, but he had been sick apparently the last few years. We had reached out, we had tried to get him for a fan fest and just wasn't doing well. So I was really sad to hear that he had passed away because he really was a tremendous guy.
And, you know, certainly if, you know, you're going to leave this mortal coil, there are worse things that you can have said about you than that. So the next guy, a guy that I really just last night finished reading the obituary in The Observer of Pampro Furpo, and a guy that obviously had a huge impact on a young Dave Meltzer because he was headlining out there. Barry, what are your memories of Pampro Furpo?
Yeah, so my memories only come from the stuff that I read in magazines and then what I've seen in hindsight. He never worked Florida. One of the few guys you can probably count on in the territory days, you know, you can count on your hands and your toes of how many guys actually never did work Florida. And Pampero is one of those guys. I'm not really sure why he didn't work Florida, but you know, he was a larger than life figure, which is interesting because stature wise, he was actually fairly small, I believe. I want to say it was like 5'8 or something. So he wasn't a big guy, but this wild mane of hair, and spent the majority of his career as a heel. But I know in Hawaii, and that's where actually I followed a lot of his career, Hawaii was called the Missing Link. And this was prior to Dewey Robertson being the Missing Link. It was kind of revered over there. So unfortunately, I never got a chance to see him. He spent the majority of his time in California. I know he worked the AWA, worked the WWWF at one point. But we never saw him. I don't know if we ever saw him in the South. Any idea? Did he ever work anywhere in the South?
No, I know he worked the territory. It was really interesting. He apparently had like a one shot with Pedro Morales where they brought him. He was actually working in Michigan with the Sheik, but they would bring him in to do a couple of quick squash matches at the tapings. And then, boom, he's in Madison Square Garden, again, I think, against Morales.
Right.
But a guy that essentially was doing the George the Animal Steel gimmick before George the Animal Steel, you know, and because people right. forget that before George the Animal Steel started doing the you and not talking, he would actually come out and do interviews. And of course, you know, legend has it that Pampro Furpo and his interview style completely was part of the influence on a young Randy Poffo. You know, the whole apparently part of what Pampro Furpo would do on his interviews. And a young Randy Poffo saw Pampro Furpo and kind of stole his gimmick because that's what, you know, that's what wrestlers do is they steal ideas from one another. So, but you know, the story that Dave told in the Observers for those that haven't had a chance to read it is that, he was a young fan. And when Pampro Furpo retired, he was working at the post office where Dave would mail the Wrestling Observer from back when they mailed the Observer as opposed to having it online like now. But so Dave said that for about a 25-30 year period, Pampro Furpo was mailing out these wrestling newsletters to people all, and Dave didn't know he worked there. And, you know, wow. So anyway, it's kind of an interesting story, you know. And the final person, Barry, is La Parca, who, of course, was a guy that died very, you know, very young, considering, but of course he was the guy that died specifically because of the result of an injury that he suffered during a match.
Yeah, too. And I remember seeing that. I believe it happened this past November, and I remember seeing the footage, and certainly was hopeful that he would get better. Obviously, I don't believe he left the hospital and he eventually passed away, but another young guy. And, you know, it's always sad too. If you're a fan of professional wrestling, and if you're listening to this podcast, the assumption is that you are a fan. When somebody dies during a match, and he did, he died, you know, injury sustained during this match, it's beyond tragic. It's the same with football. Whenever you see somebody who either is paralyzed or, you know, it's absolutely tragic. So when this news hit, and again, four deaths in wrestling in a week, that's a little, that almost goes back to the 90s when we were, you know, losing guys at a record pace. For different reasons, obviously, but just tragic. And again, a guy that was 54, and this was, just to clarify, the second La Parca, the original La Parca, the guy that had been in WCW, that was the chairman, I believe wrestles now as L.A. Park. So it is a different guy, but just a tragedy, no doubt.
Yeah. So now, after that somewhat downbeat opening, let's hope we don't have to do an episode where we talk about four wrestling deaths plus a rock legend. So let's now move to our match of the week. As I discussed, our match of the week is from August 15th, 1983. We're taking a look at some old Jimmy Garvin matches since Jim was very gracious and decided to give us a part two of the interview with him. So Barry, Will Rogers Coliseum, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell us what you thought.
Yeah, so this is a really good match. So you said something, I think, before we started recording, and Jeff, you were 100% correct when you said that. But
thank you. I appreciate that.
Absolutely. This match goes by in a blink of an eye, even though it's a little over 21 minutes. And part of it is what I really like about this is this is where this is booking done correctly. This right here is, I think, the blueprint for booking done correctly. And when I say that, there's a lot of bad blood between these four guys. You've got Gordy and Garvin on one side. And then you've got Kevin and David Von Erich on the other side. And literally the moment that Kevin and David get in the ring, it's a fucking full out brawl taking place. Kevin jumps Garvin, beating the shit out of him. And you got to admit, how stiff does Kevin look? And you hear these stories of how stiff Kevin was, but holy shit, I'm sitting and I'm just cringing because he's laying these in and there's no way this shit isn't connecting, Jeff. Looks really, really good. David and Gordy are battling, which I think is a really good matchup there based off of the height. And then Kevin does this standing drop kick on Garvin. He still has on his ring jacket. The standing drop kick is essentially Kevin's 2 feet to Garvin's face. And this isn't like a Tony Atlas situation. I don't think Garvin actually appreciated that.
I'm sure he did appreciate the toes coming in contact with
exactly.
His face.
That's the last thing you fucking want. You know, is somebody's feet like in your face. He gets, but my point being, he's like 5.5 feet with a standing drop kick right in the guy's face. That's absolutely incredible. The heels then are outside the ring because they've been thrown out. They start throwing chairs in the ring. It looks like a dangerous situation. There's just like bodies flying, chairs are flying. Sunshine's trying to take cover, and she's like in a corner outside. But just really an amazing start to the match. And the match really never lets up. It goes 80 miles an hour from start to finish. Referee in this match, Jeff, this was a thought I had. Lou, I want to call you in for this one as well. Referee for this match was Jerry Usher. And I don't think Jerry made it too much longer. I want to say that within the next year or so, Jerry was done. But Jerry was a territory wrestler going back to the 60s. We saw him in Florida. I think it was 73 he came in. And I think there was a connection a lot of times with the Funk Brothers as well. But, you know, you go back and you watch, and I think World Class was a great example. And we did a match out of Houston, I don't know, a year ago, Jeff, with Danny McShane, where I made a reference. I think Danny McShane was about 8,000 years old. What was that old Carl Reiner deal? Was it the 8,000-year-old man? Was that what that was?
It was a 1,000-year-old man, wasn't it?
No, 1,000-year-old. 2,000.
Oh, okay. We're both okay. Wrong.
Carl Reiner and Mel Brooks. Wrong. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you go back to the 80s, and then, you know, there definitely was a transition period. But all the referees, literally in every territory, were almost always old guys. A lot of them were always old retired wrestlers. I think World Class was the bastion of that because you had Bronco Lubitsch. God bless him. Rest in peace. I think he made wrestling better because it made it more fun for me. But do you remember Bronco trying to get down on the mat?
He would go down to one knee and still do the slowest count in wrestling.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
It was like 10 or 15 seconds later where Bronco's still trying to get down.
Well, I think points, too, he also just, you know, said, why bother and just make the count with his foot?
Let's just say that Bronco did not have the agility of a Tommy Young in his prime.
Right. So what was the transition of the old? This is where I was going with that. What was the transition of the old retired wrestler to a guy that could actually move? And I realize guys like Tommy Young and Scrappy McGowan were always around. But, you know, wrestling in the 70s, primarily the referees, they were these guys that were in their 60s or 70s or possibly even 80s. Where do we see the transition? Was it the expansion era?
Well, you know, Florida also had Frenchie Bernard, who was a younger guy. And then, of course, in the early 80s is when Bill Alfonso started showing up on our televisions, you know, who was obviously a much more agile guy. So I would say late 70s into the early 80s.
Gotcha. Lou, what do you say on that one?
Yeah, I, considering, yeah, my own fandom began in 84, and the AWA was coming out to San Francisco. So you get to see, really, really seasoned referees like Marty Miller and, was it Kenny the Sodbuster J?
Well, Nick Bockwinkel's brother was a ref, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, Bob Warren.
Yeah, actually. Yeah, and he was in Florida at one point too, which would have been 77 or 78. He spent about a month down here. But and then, and look, they were
transitioned
around.
To Scott Ledoux.
Scott Ledoux, and then also the Crusher's son, Larry Lazowski, became a ref. Right. I think once you transition in from the territory era, where it's just guys eating bologna sandwiches and pouring beer on their trips in the territory, to, you know, the Vince's Circus, where you're going 2,000 miles every day, or, you know, a flight here, a flight there. That's, you know, could you see Bronk going to O'Hare and then to Milwaukee and then to whatever airports?
Working those 10-hour TV tapings? Yeah, that might be a problem for Bronco.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What was the guy's name in the WWF, little Hispanic guy?
Gilberto Ramon?
Gilberto Ramon.
Yes.
Everybody's least favorite ref.
He always got the midget match.
Which
is a plus.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Little Tokyo's going to bite me in the ass again. Fantastic.
That's about it.
All right. So getting back to the matches, I took a left turn that went off into a whole different area. Terry Gordy as a bump taker. I think not just because people will always say one of the premier big man bump takers. I think just one of the premier bump takers of all time. His bumps that he takes, absolutely incredible. Taking the fact out that he's 260, 270 pounds, whatever it is. Mark Lorenz during this match comes up with some great lines here. Kevin has Gordy in the head scissors, and Mark Lorenz comes up with the gem. Kevin learned how to use his legs years ago in the Orient. So I don't know what the fuck that means.
You were walking on his back. Somehow that gave him,
I guess.
Yeah. I gotta tell you, I don't mean to interrupt you, sure. But yeah, you're right. This might be my favorite Mark Lorenz match of all time because he's so just comes up with stuff, and he's not trying to be. This isn't, you know, no, Jim Ross trying to be funny or Joey Styles. This is Mark is dropping gold. Like at one point he says, when they're choking on Kevin, and he says, you know what? They're doing that on purpose.
He does a lot. He's got another one too. When they're all four in the ring, and this is right around where we get to the finish, and they're just beating the shit out of each other. Mark comes up with the line, "You couldn't put me in that ring for love or money," which is great. But I really enjoyed this match, and my comment earlier about 0 to 80, it is that this match is full throttle all the way out, and it makes it so exciting. So I. Two big fat thumbs up for me, guys.
Two fleshy thumbs ups.
Fleshy. Yes, sir.
Yeah. And Lou, I know you were telling us that you thought the crowd at this match was just insane.
Absolutely. If there was one match that just instantly rekindled nostalgia for me for Southern wrestling, and by God, World Class was a prime example. It was something like this. Also, the fact that it came from Championship Sports at Saturday Night Show, which we don't see much of. So it's a different crowd, a little larger than the Sportatorium. And you got to see a 2 or 3 falls match with talent of this caliber. I guess you could say, Jeff, it was the penultimate.
Well,
for me.
I would never say that because I'd get chastised on the board for saying that. So, gentlemen, quick question. The ring announcer, was it it Rinaldi?
So let's talk about Joe Rinelli for a minute.
Rinelli. Okay.
Was there he's since passed on, because if he was alive, he would be about 100 years old. So I'm going to assume he's passed on. But was there a worse choice to make someone a ring announcer than Joe Rinelli?
The only person I'm going to think of is Joe McHugh. I'm Joe McHugh.
Yeah, but at least there was some sort of swagger when he did it. Joe Rinelli seems like he's got like he's eating a bagel when he's announcing. So you don't full get it. But do you know Joe Rinelli was a Fort Worth stockbroker, wrestling ring announcer, and get this, a beauty queen trainer?
Wasn't that a Seinfeld episode?
I don't know. What the fuck is a beauty queen trainer, beauty right?
Queen oh, Cosmo trainer. Kramer did that.
It's pimp. This guy was a pimp is what he was. So,
oh my God. Yeah. Did he have to like give a little, did you have to wet Moolah's beak every time she came into town?
There's a t-shirt. Wetting Moolah's beak. I love it. Yeah,
exactly. wetting Moolah's beak for 2.5 years now.
Oh man.
So the other thing I want to talk about was, you know, you see this match and, you know, Lou was talking about how this just showed him why he loves Southern wrestling. I got to tell you something. I watched this match and I forgot how good at ringside at this point in her life that Sunshine was. Her facials, during the match, when she's selling, when Jimmy's getting hit, you know, slammed around and the camera cuts to her. Oh my God. She's just a range of emotions from, you know, yin to yang. And I love when there's a spot where they, the camera cuts on her and Lawrence, and another great line says, yes, there's Sunshine wearing leather. and he has like the dramatic pause, just like that. Like apparently Mark and his values were being compromised by the leather outfit that Sunshine was wearing. So the other great comment I thought that, or at least another one that Mark had was he at one point says, I intended to talk about the great card that's getting ready to come to Corsicana, but I can't. It's just too wild in here. So the first fall goes in 8 minutes and 33 seconds. David Von Erich pinned clean in the middle by Terry Gordy, which that was something that soon afterwards would not necessarily just David, but the Von Erich boys were not known for their clean pins in the middle. Second fall, David gets the return as he pins Gordy at 1:59 of the second fall. The third fall goes to a double DQ. But let's talk, you know, I touched upon it briefly with Lou. The crowd was just crazy in this match, and it just showed how much that Jimmy and Sunshine had connected with, you know, besides the fact that the girls are there to see David and Kevin and Carrie, you know, whatever match she worked on the card. But these girls, boy, they hated Jimmy and Sunshine, Barry.
They really did too. And I'll agree with you about Sunshine also. She looked great, but her selling and the way her reactions were just tremendous. But the crowd did, and you know, we've said this during our conversation with gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, but I'm hard pressed. I don't think that we will ever see in this country, at least if for the foreseeable future, a crowd that was as hot as the world class crowd was. I would guess 82 through 84, 85, somewhere in that neighborhood. They're just off the charts.
And they totally believed, you know, and that's what makes it great, is that they were completely caught up in the whole, everything that was happening, completely spellbound by the action and the characters that they were watching. And at the end of the match, to quote Mark Lawrence, as Harry Carey would say, holy cow. So this is a match I really would encourage you to seek it out and watch it, even if you think the match is just so-so, which it's not. But just watch the crowd and the way the crowd is reacting to everything. It is great. And Mark Lawrence in this match, he was really, really good. For a guy that's never thought of as a good announcer, he was unintentionally hilarious in calling the action. And I just really loved it. So now, speaking of Jimmy Garvin, it is time for us now, Barry, to go to part two of our interview with Jimmy Garvin. And in this part, Jimmy is going to cover his time in world class. Jimmy is going to tell you folks stuff that will, I dare say, at the end of part two, when Jimmy discusses some folks that he associated with up in Montreal, that's curl your hair time. So get ready for that, folks, as Jimmy talks about some guys outside the wrestling business that he was seen having dinner with. So that's pretty good stuff. So let's go to our part two of our interview with gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Okay, and it is time now, Barry, for part two of our interview with It Is Not My Fault, gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Jimmy, welcome back. It's good to talk to you again, my brother.
Hello, gentlemen. It's my pleasure as well, as always, to hear your voice and have conversation with you. Hope everybody's doing okay.
Absolutely. So, Barry, I think where we left off was the debut of gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Now, as I recollect, Barry, you tell me if I'm wrong here. The week before he became gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, he showed up on the CWF set, was talking to Gordon, may have mentioned something about he's getting ready to go on a tour of Japan, just thought he'd stop by and say hello to everybody. And then the next week, J.J. Dillon debuts gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Is that about right there, Bear?
Yeah, you're correct, sir.
Yeah, 100%.
100%.
Absolutely. So, and then the other thing was he came out to the opening chords of Pink Floyd's Money. So, Jimmy, yeah, whose idea was it to use the theme song?
All right. Well, the theme song was mine. And the whole concept, I think when we left off, and I think I didn't tell the story, but we were going to continue it on this stage two area, was I was riding back with Ernie Ladd and a couple of the boys from West Palm Beach. And I remember we was in a van because we were sitting in the back of it, and Ernie Ladd and I were talking, and he goes, Jim, he says, you know, he says, you got a good background and you can wrestle and everything. He says, but, you know, unless you have a gimmick, you know, you're not going to break that barrier. You know, it's just, you need to have a gimmick. And then I thought to myself, well, yeah. And I told him too, I said, well, yeah, you're probably right. You know, cause I only had like, you know, a couple pair of tights and I was pretty plain Jane, you know, back in the day, if you didn't have a gimmick, which I didn't have one, it was just me and what I, you know, normal stuff. But it stayed in my mind. And I thought about it and thought about it after I, you know, got home. And from the time he said it, I don't think I quit thinking about it too much. Of course I did, but you know, I kept going back to it. And then I started thinking, I need a gimmick. Now, what kind of gimmick am I going to have? And I thought about it and thought about it. And I thought about Gorgeous George, hadn't been around since the 50s, more or less, with the valet. And then, you know, the valet thing kind of hit me. And I remember Bobby Shane with his valet. But, you know, it was dated. It wasn't exposed a lot at all. And, you know, there was another guy in Alabama or something with the valet, but that was all like local stuff. So I said, I need to make an international version, you know, that this thing can blast, you know, all over the world with. And so I came up with the Gorgeous George character, which leaded into the sequence, tuxedos, because I didn't want a big robe and I wasn't going to curl my hair and throw bobby pins out. I mean, so I had to take a Gorgeous George from the 50s and update him to the current time. And I believe that what I did in the finished product was I had an updated Gorgeous George, you know, with the valet and with the sequined tuxedos and the boot covers and the gloves. So I got the sparkle in there, and Gorgeous George could wrestle too, and I didn't have any problem there. And there was no real valets that were making the news, I guess is the way you could say it. Because like I say, the two valets that I remember, which was Bobby Shane's, and you might remember, who was the guy in Alabama that had the girl? He kind of, his hair was kind of all, he was an English guy, maybe.
Adrian Street?
Yeah, maybe. Did he have like Miss Linda or something?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. And then, you know, he didn't travel the country, you know, with her, as far as I know, that much anyway, or didn't make it that, and I'm not saying anything bad about him. I respect him and all his work and everything he did, but I was going for bigger and better things. And that was how that happened. So that's how the Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin and Precious was created.
Gotcha. So I have to ask you too, Jimmy. So the Precious that really hit the national stage, everybody knows, was your wife, Patty. But she was not the first Precious. There was another young lady that was around. Mm-hmm. She looked very young, maybe early 20s, that was actually the first Precious when you were Gorgeous Jimmy Garvin. Whatever happened to her?
Well, you know, when her and I got together and doing the thing, I think she's about 13. No, I'm just kidding.
There you go.
yeah, right. No, I'm not being funny, but no, she was you know, somebody that fit the bill and did what she needed to do, and you know, needed the job. So I give her the job, and you know, but then, you know, the limousine would come and pick me up at my house and she would come knock on the door. And my wife, you know, at first was like, okay, you know, all right. Then that went on for a while. And then, you know, after a couple of months, finally, my wife, Patty said, you know, we're going to have to do something because this ain't going in the right direction, so to speak. And I can't blame her, you know, it'd be like if some guy came and picked her up, you know, to go on the road, you know, almost every night. So, I mean, I completely understand that. And I said, okay, I'll fix it. And, that's when I got my cousin Valerie, to do it. Cause I said, well, you know, she's part of the family. She's my first cousin. And, you know, that, and she was a nice looking girl. You remember Sunshine.
Oh, yeah.
And then, so Sunshine was created to take Precious's place, and that's who she debuted in Texas, because David was down here in Florida, and he says, when you finish here in Florida, come to Dallas and we'll do something. So I showed up in Dallas with Sunshine and myself, and of course, you know, that started that huge record-breaking session.
So Jim, before we get to Texas, and I do want to, you know, spend some time talking with you about Texas. Do you have any memories of working in Florida with Rufus R. Jones and JJ and the weasel suit matches and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I vaguely remember that, but I do remember that. I think, like I mentioned to you, you know, that they had bumper stickers out that said the weasel, and that weasel thing caught on. And we just run with it, you know, but I don't have really clear specific memories other than I do remember the angle kind of thing as far as with the weasel thing. I mean, it was a gimmick that was, you know, had a little fire to it, you know?
So you mentioned working in Florida with David Von Erich, and David Von Erich's heel run here in Florida in 1982 is one of our favorite topics because I was such a big fan of David as a heel. What do you remember, you know, first meeting David in Florida, if that was when you first met him, and what you thought of him as a heel?
Oh, that was the first time I met him. And I thought he was a great heel. I thought it was good that he broke away and got out of Texas. I would dare to say that he was the most talented of the brothers, especially when it came to psychology. And I do think that he would have eventually went on to be world champion. If I had a prediction to make, I have no idea. It's just a prediction, but I also had heard through the grapevine type rumor mill that they were actually grooming him to take the heavyweight title. But that again is only a rumor that I heard, but he certainly would have made a good champion, because he was just talented. He knew how to be a heel. He knew how to be a babyface. He had excellent skills, and he had great psychology, and he was a really, really close friend of mine. And we rode together to the towns. He stayed at my house. Kevin stayed at my house in West Tampa, and, you know, we were like brothers, you know, we were really close.
Only heel ever to wear a roach clip, during an interview, which is always just slayed me that he would wear the roach clip during his interviews.
Yeah. Yeah. With the feathers on it.
Exactly. You know,
with the feathers exactly. Just dangling down the end.
That's absolutely he was a
great individual. He was a really good person. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that rumor too, that you mentioned too, is something I think a lot of us have heard. And we had Dory Funk Jr. on with us, I guess about a year ago, maybe a little bit longer. Then, yeah. And Dory, who was the booker at the time when David came into Florida, actually confirmed that he also was under the impression that they were grooming him for the world's heavyweight title. So one of the guys that was around when you were around in Florida, I wanted to ask you, because he's one of my favorites of all time, was Ernie Ladd. Any good stories about Ernie Ladd?
No, I never, not only the only, you know, that time, you know, the rare time that we would travel together, because I think he was allergic to smoke or something, so that we didn't make good traveling companions. but when I was around him, He was always a gentleman, you know. He had been in, you know, the NFL, and you know, he'd been around sports, and but I never really got close to him. Like, we never sat down and had a beer and or a case of beer or whatever, you know, was the case, you know, at the time. So I really wasn't that close to him.
So, Jim, then you make your way to World Class. Now, you had been in CWF when CWF, of course, was still a really hot promotion during the 70s and stuff like that. But had you ever seen anything like the insanity that was World Class when the Freebirds and the Von Erichs exploded and then you came in there? Had you ever seen anything like that?
Well, no, I certainly was the first time I was exposed to that level. And I was, it was almost simultaneously that the Birds came in and got with the Von Erichs. And then it wasn't a very, very long at all. Somebody might know exactly, but I would say maybe a couple of months or something, because the World Class wasn't really doing anything. I mean, it was there, but I mean, it wasn't like it was, you know, on fire or getting ready to do what it eventually did. So then the Von Erichs hit first. So that would be the first run with the first explosion. And then with following up with me coming in there and working, you know, with David, you know, second explosion. And then from there on out, it was a complete, you know, I mean, it was nobody's touched it yet, as far as, you know, I'm not talking WWE stuff. I'm talking territorially, you know, where, you know, Channel 39 was going all, you know, eventually went all over the country, like Boston and places like that. And, you know, Kansas City and St. Louis, and we were being booked out of Dallas into, you know, Kansas City and St. Louis and places like that. At least Chris Adams and I, you know, Chris Adams, myself and Precious were being booked out. But no, that was the beginning of what put WCW on the map. WCCW, or whatever the hell it was called. The Birds started it, and then I came in and we finished it together, and we took every bit of it and we burned it down to the ground. You know, as far as, there wasn't nothing left when we left. I think Jerry Jarrett had to come in there and do something. And then, you know, I even think Sunshine came back in and tried to do something, and they did a little bit, but it was nothing like the, you know, 84, 80, end of 83 type of thing. 84 was really the year, 83 and 84. It was just insanity as far as sellouts, automatic sellouts everywhere we went. It would sell out, you know, right away, you know, constantly. If it didn't sell out, something was wrong. Most everything sold out, or pretty much sold out everywhere we went.
Yeah, and our group loves when we talk about World Class Championship Wrestling, too. So, Sweet Lou Kippelman, all the way from the City by the Bay, San Francisco, just shot us a text and said he's been watching WCCW on the WWE Network. And when you first came into the territory, part of your gimmick was that you wouldn't let your matches be recorded for television. Sweet Lou is wondering, did you come up with that, dear, or was that something that Booker Ken Mantell had come up with?
No, that was my stuff. One of the things that I always kind of required was more or less that I along with Michael, between Michael and I, we would get together and figure out what angles we were going to do with who. Ken Mantell, of course, had a lot to do with it because he was the actual Booker title guy. But Mike and myself, you know, we kind of Mike also did the booking or the creative for the Freebirds, and I did the creative for my character myself. So yeah, I came up with that myself. Anything that I did was put through me or from me before it was done, or I just wouldn't do it. You know.
So Jim, let me ask you. Go ahead. Go ahead and finish up if you were going.
I just said that my point behind that was that because I created the character, I had a vision for the character, and I had a vision in the direction that I wanted the character to go. So I wasn't going to let somebody else come and tell me what vision they had and what vision they wanted it to go, because that's not how it worked. You know, that would be like somebody coming in and telling Walt Disney, you know, that, you know, he wants, you know, Mickey Mouse to be Chinese or something. You know, that's just not what, you know, Walt's plans were, and that's the way it was. So I was the same way. I mean, I knew I had a gimmick that only I really understood the velocity of it and the potential. Of course, they seen the potential, but they didn't have a clue as to, you know, how they, you can't, the machine has to do the work, you know. You can't just, you know,
you're essentially talking creative control before that word maybe came to be.
Yeah, exactly. That would be very well said. Yeah.
So Jim, I did an article back towards the end of the 1980s where I talked about the top 20 moments of the 80s, not necessarily matches, like, you know, maybe vignettes or angles or something like that. And I'm happy to tell you that you were involved directly and indirectly with two of the top 20. The first one was, of course, Valet for a Day with David and you and Sunshine, which mm-hmm. was absolutely just the gold standard, as far as I'm concerned, for any valet for a day, because I know it's been tried in other territories after that. But please tell us your memories of that angle and maybe that day.
Well, that angle came with, you know, Michael and I sitting around and, you know, having a few beers and thinking about stuff. And, you know, we put something together. And then, of course, David, you know, being with the last name he had, if we took it to David and said, hey, Dave, you know, this is what we're thinking, you know, and of course, Dave could realize the potential as soon as he heard what we were thinking. So Michael and I put it together and wrote it and pretty much, you know, did all the creative for it. And it was pretty much done in one take. There was no retakes or that type of thing where, you know, you'd have to cut and then try it over again. It wasn't that way at all. We had it down in our minds, myself, Sunshine, David. We knew exactly where we were going with it. Mike was there to, you know, again, just as a set of eyes on our side of the fence, you know, watching what we were doing. And it was just, I don't think the wrestling business had seen anything like that until then. And I could be wrong, but as far as a vignette type thing, like that, I don't think there was really anything of that caliber ever done. Do you guys know?
Barry, I don't really remember anything along those lines. Do you?
Not like that too. You know, here was the funny thing. I think there was some angles that came later that we're copying, and we all know that in professional wrestling, a lot of stuff goes around, but I think Jimmy may have kind of been the originator with that angle.
Yeah, I think I was, for whatever that's worth, you know, but it's, again, it's just because, you know, you get in a different, set of eyes, or you get in a different thought, a person that's creative, and you're going to have different, you know, you're going to have these things pop up. And that's what happened. It was just a natural thing for Michael and I to get together and come up with these ideas. And, you know, we didn't strike out too much, if any at all, on any of the angles we did. I mean, including the turn, you know, when the valets, when I brought, Patty in, as Precious, because she was going to be Sunshine's valet, you know, that was my creative control, you know, along with everything else. But that was all, you know, my stuff.
Well, that brings me to the second angle or second thing that was my top 20 of the 80s, and that's the Sunshine press conference, which was
heavy duty, wasn't it?
Oh my God, it was absolutely perfect. So who's was that, you and Michael again, that came up with the idea for the Sunshine press conference?
Yeah, that was you know, me and Michael and I together worked really good together creatively, And we wouldn't step on each other's feet either, because you know he was good at what he did, and I was good at my gimmick. But I could suggest something I could give him like an outside look in, and he could do the same for me. So with both of us together, the finished product was pretty polished.
Gotcha.
So yeah.
So a name that you mentioned a couple of minutes back was Gentleman Chris Adams. And as Jeff knows, and I mentioned this last week too, I'm a huge Chris Adams fan, especially if you go into his work in World Class, which I think was his best work, at least in the United States. So you spent a lot of time with Chris Adams. You know, a lot's been written about his life, his lifestyle, that there were two different Chris Adams. But what kind of memories and positive memories do you have of Chris?
Well, you know, the one thing that I had going for me was when Chris came in, I think he was in Oregon before he was in Dallas. And then I'm not sure about that, but yeah, that's good. That's a miracle. But yeah, he came in, and the fact of the matter was he was straight level. You know, he was ready. You know, he was young. Obviously, all of us were. And he had not been introduced into the dark side yet. So if I could put it that way. So when he came in, he was like a clean slate. So he didn't draw nothing nowhere else. I mean, he didn't have time. He just wasn't here. He wasn't in Oregon long enough. And plus he wasn't getting the push that he was going to get when he got with me. But, it'd give him his, I would say it was his first time ever getting into a major angle that could carry a whole territory, and he was excellent, and like I said, because he was fresh and he hadn't been polluted yet, we would have great matches and got along with him well. Terrific to work with, very skilled, and his timing and everything was good. We could think together along the lines as we're working. We're both on the same page. We're both heading in the same direction for the same outcome. And it was a totally positive experience. Then later on, now, and you think about it, when I left Dallas, he was still good. Now there was a little drinking going. I mean, hell, nobody drank more than the birds, but I can't talk about that. But then when we left, I think when it really went downhill was after we left, you know, then things weren't the same. You know, that place like went dark. It was like somebody turned all the lights off as far as I was concerned, because there was no, you had Eric Embry or I don't even know. And I'm not talking bad about any of the talents because I don't do that. But I mean, let's just, they weren't ringing no bells, and they weren't selling out nowhere, and they never did after that. So I think that affected Chris, and then he got in the wrong company. And with that, along with the fact that, he just got out of the largest angle that he was ever going to be in his life, because of what happened, but, it was his first and last. And he kind of, you know, he knew that angle was gone. And I think that probably had a lot to do with it, because then he wasn't wrestling in St. Louis or Kansas City or selling out, you know, Reunion Arena or San Antonio or anywhere else we went. So, I mean, I think that he turned to the stuff that will kill you and has killed a lot of my friends, and that's drugs. And anybody out there, you know, that's listening and doing that crap, they need to, go put their head in the toilet or something and, you know, flush it for a minute and get away from that crap, because it only leads to destruction. So we all know, you know, most of us know that. It's just unfortunate that it's happened to so many of the guys, you know, whether it's steroids or cocaine or, you know, whatever, you know.
Well, Jim, do you think it's part of the, you have the visceral high of the match, and you come back to, you know, hotel or home, and you need to come down And then the next morning you need something to get you up, and it becomes a never ending cycle almost. I know that's was the supposed schedule of the guys, you know, when the WWF first broke out national. But was that as big a deal in the territories, or was it mainly just alcohol, do you think?
No, I think really it was, let's think about that. That's when the whole country, that's when Studio 54, you know, and all that stuff. I mean, cocaine was the dessert of choice, so to speak. It was rampant. It was everywhere. And for us, it was free, you know, so, and everything else was free, you know, so that didn't help. Because you had the, and that's the way it went in show business and sports entertainment, because of the, and all over America, it was that eighties was the decade of decadence, so to speak. You know,
I mean, excess.
They had ecstasy. I mean, there was been in bars. They had people just passing out ecstasy pills and cocaine being laid out on the table, and you know, and God only knows, you know, I mean, it wasn't like a big, you know, heroin type thing. That's debilitating and stupid to start with. But I mean, and cocaine's no smarter either, and neither is ecstasy. But it was, the '80s were a time, and I do mention Studio 54 just as an example. I mean, that shit was all over the place. You didn't have to be a wrestler to be on coke or take ecstasy. I mean, everybody was taking it, not just the wrestlers. When I say everybody, I mean everybody that was doing the nightlife thing, you know. So then you throw that in on top of the fact that you're getting it for free, and then you throw the fact that it didn't matter if it cost money anyway, because in that time money was growing on trees for all of us, so money wasn't even a question. So I mean, there was no excuse. So, you, I mean, you couldn't say, oh, man, I can't afford that. Well, of course, you know, afford anything you want, you know, but you don't even have to buy it. It's free, you know. Yeah. It was just, okay, well, you know, you want a glazed donut? Well, how much does it cost? No, it's free. In fact, here's a whole dozen of glazed donuts.
Whoa.
How much are they? Well,
free donuts.
You know, they're free. You know,
Jeez.
You know.
Now you're talking my language, so, Jimmy.
Well, you see what I mean? So there's somebody to say, you know. Yeah, here's I mean, I don't even want, I mean, cocaine and ecstasy and drugs and stuff like that. It was rough. I mean, because, and if you back it up into the 70s, and I think about Bill Watts' territory, everybody was doing the speed to keep them awake, because Bill Watts had us driving all over the freaking country from New Orleans to Tulsa. You know, being in New Orleans one night and doing TV in Oklahoma City or Tulsa the next day, well, hell, you'd have to drive all night. It was a bunch of bull crap, you know. Actually, it was bullshit, actually, is what it was. But, you know, you know, I mean, so the 80s was that period in a lot of areas, and it just really hit wrestling. And then if you were a star, something like that, I mean, my gosh, you know, there was no end, you know.
Well, Jim, let me ask you a question here, because I want to just finish up with a couple of world class questions. You know, you briefly touched on the fact that, you know, you and Precious were or Patty were going to different St. Louis, Kansas City with Chris and Sunshine. And, you know, I think I spoke to Barry about this before we recorded the very first part of our show. You guys were really, in a way, and I'm not talking about the WWE and their national touring, but you were the first feud or angle that got taken national, I think.
Yes,
you know,
sir. Yes,
you guys, because you guys took that angle to Mid-South too, didn't you? And worked a few shows for Bill Watts.
Yeah, we sure did, and sold them out too.
Yeah, so you know that was
everywhere we went. That gimmick, and see, that was the plan all along. That's why Ken Mantell or nobody else could book it, or not book it, but do the creative, because I knew where I wanted to go with the creative part. And that was, and we, you know, we took, I took Patty to Japan. We went to Japan as well. And, you know, I mean, it was worldwide. And then when I went to AWA, I'll just skip ahead just for a quick second. But the fact of the matter is, and the truth of the matter is, when I went to go to AWA, the WWF contacted me, and it was actually Joe Scarpa that was an agent at the time had talked to me, and they wanted me to bring the gimmick to New York. Well, I didn't want to really go to New York because at the time I had seen some of the guys that went from the NWA up to WWF, and they, you know, they were either marching around with a 2x4 on, you know, ho ho ho, or you know, like Dusty, he had a polka dot trunks, you know, and a nice African American valet that
Sapphire,
you know, was basically. Yeah, Sapphire, which is basically a joke. And that's what he would do, in my opinion, to the talent from the NWA, because we were, it's like the North and the South of the Civil War. You fight for the South all your career, and all of a sudden the South, you know, all the potatoes are gone. So now you want to go to the North. Well, you've been fighting the North. That stuff is easily forgotten, and Vince don't forget nothing. So I didn't want to take my gimmick into that environment because I knew that I would lose control and he'd end up asking me to do something really stupid. And then I'd end up telling him to shove it up his arse and then I'd leave because I didn't do anything I didn't want to do anyway. It probably cost me a few million, but that didn't matter. I was an outlaw as far as that goes. Don't be telling, you're not going to tell me to do something that I don't think is right, I'm just not going to do it. So I went to the AWA and made a lot of money for them, you know, and did well there. Well, then what happened, I guess where I was going with this, all of a sudden, Randy Savage and Miss Elizabeth show up. They didn't show up. They weren't created before my character and Precious, you know, that was, I didn't go to New York. So they created their own, well, they tried to create their own. And even then, I mean, you know, it wasn't as intense. Nothing gets more intense than watching Sunshine and Precious go at it in a tag match with me and Chris. I mean, a mixed tag match. That was huge because, like I told you earlier, those girls couldn't work. So they were shooting. And it was a serious angle, you know, because everybody's seen Sunshine's press conference. And everybody knows that the way the story was told that Patty double-crossed her and, you know, I slapped her around in Fort Worth and brought her over the top rope by her hair. And she took a bump and she was on her knees going, please, Jimmy, please, you know, begging. And I'm pointing down at her. I got her by the back of the hair like some kind of caveman. I mean, that shit, I mean, those people wanted to kill me and Patty too. And we turned Sunshine into a huge baby face overnight with that match in Fort Worth. And then you were talking about the films that nobody, you know, like she said in the press conference, she had all my tapes and she was going to hand them over, you know, and blah, 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 and da, da, da. And it just went boom, 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 just like I planned it all the way through, except I didn't really plan the Sunshine. And you probably get to this, but if you don't, I'll say it now so you won't have to worry about it. But Sunshine was fabulous. She was really excellent, first class, number one. She was a pro because she got taken from Tampa, just a normal girl, and I needed a valet. And I said, come on, we're going to Texas. And on the way to Texas, I explained to her what we were going to do. And that was her – she got thrown into it head first. And right on fire, right off the bat, and she never missed a beat. And she had no prior experience whatsoever. She was a natural. But then what had happened? We always hung with the Birds. In fact, I had that apartment across the street that I never lived in, and she didn't either because we all stayed at the Birds. We all stayed together. Well, we'd drink Jack Daniels till the sun come up, and she got to where she could drink a half a gallon. Her and Buddy, they'd keep going. Buddy Roberts, they'd go for a while. And then that, you know, you do that for a few months and then things aren't turning out too good because it's too much alcohol for her. It wasn't too much for us so much because we could handle it. And, you know, if there's such a thing as we could handle it, that's famous last words of anybody that drinks Jack Daniels. So I could handle it. Right? But I could see my cousin was not, it was taking its toll on my cousin. And she wasn't experienced enough to realize that you got to, if you're going to go down that fiery road, or if you're going to walk that tightrope, you better make sure that you don't fall or something, because your chances are you're going to. And she did. And she was going to hit hard. And I couldn't have her do that if she was family. And I just said, look, I can't do it. I can't continue letting this happen to you. I got to replace you. And it wasn't a real pleasant thing. I mean, but her and I were cousins, relative type thing. And it had to be done. So let's make some money doing it. And then I came home and told Patty, I said, Patty, I need a valet. And I don't have nobody else to get. So you're going to have to do it. And, you know, she shot me the bird and told me to F off, you know, that she ain't, that's totally opposite of her character. You know, she was taking care of my girls at home and she had nothing to do with it. And then the next thing you know, she's on TV and I'm presenting her to Valerie, Sunshine, to be her valet. So it'd take the work off of Sunshine, which was all the part of the angle. And then, of course, you know, you put two women together with one man. I've said it 1,000 times, and it's never going to work. I don't care if you do it in real life or on the movies. It don't work. Two women and one man don't work. There's going to be a problem somewhere. They're not going to retire happily ever after and ride off into the sunset, all three of them on one horse.
I'm willing to try, though, Jimmy. I'm willing to try.
I don't blame you because it could be a lot of fun, but. You know, there's a lot of high risk to it, too. So that's kind of how that got developed. And then, of course, it just exploded. It was like there never was an angle like that before. And there never will be another angle like the Sunshine and Precious and Chris Adams and me. And that also started the valets in the business and the girls that, you know, all the WWE, WWF, whatever you want to call them, you know, girls were coming out of the woodwork. Now everybody had a valet kind of thing, or they were trying to do an angle with the Miss Elizabeth, you know, and God bless her and may she rest in peace. But, you know, I mean, there's the difference between Miss Elizabeth and my girls were the difference between a color TV and a black and white TV. And I was also not only in color, but I was in high definition, meaning my girls were like, they were the shit. I mean, they had personality, they had expression. They would speak their mind. They could tell a story. You look on the other side of the page and it was like always the same look of, you know, there was never the drama. Did you feel there was drama in anything that anybody else did that even came close to the drama that we created? Can you think of anybody?
No, but I think partly, I think the difference too, I think the world-class fans, and we have said this multiple times, may have been the most passionate wrestling fans in the history of the business. That was something that I don't think we will ever see again. So they were completely vested. But Jimmy, I have a question for you. And I've again, we, Jeff and I and Sweet Lou, we love having you on the show because, you know, you are breaking kayfabe. You're very honest with this. But Gino Hernandez was somebody that you obviously knew out there. And the so I'm going to hit you with the big question. There has been speculation that Gino just didn't die of a drug overdose, that Gino was actually murdered. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, the only way I can explain it is like this. It's like an airplane that has an accident or an aircraft accident. You can say what you can speculate because you weren't there and you don't know and you're not part of the investigation. And until the investigation's over and the thorough investigation from the NTSB, you really never know. And then, you know, they have a chance that they might be a little wrong. So from my perspective, it's speculation that I don't doubt that at all. It's highly likely. It's highly likely that that's what happened. But can I say, I believe that's what happened. I can't say that. I can just say that I can, that is a very good possibility And I lean towards that more than I lean towards the fact that he overdosed.
Correct.
Is that what they finally came up with? Okay. Well, so what kills that is this. I mean, everybody, there's been a lot of people that's overdosed, but most of the time, most people know, especially if you've been doing it a while, what your limitations are, especially in our group, because we know our limitations because they're tested every day. So we're real familiar with what our limitations are. And he knew his limitations. Now, can you have an accident or, you know, an overdose? Yeah, you can. I'm not, of course you can. It happens a lot. I don't know the percentages, but it does. But I also know that, you know, with the crowd that Gino was running with, wasn't exactly from the church group. And, you know, if you get into that stuff in the wrong, you know, you get in the wrong area with the wrong people, it's not hard to disappear or be put out of the picture. So my thought about that is, you know, I'm as much information that I have, which is barely none, except knowing him, it just seems like, and he had a good future, you know, and it wasn't a money issue, you know, him and Bosch were, you know, needless to say, pretty close. But yeah, we just don't know, right? I mean, we just don't know. We just don't know.
So, Jim, speaking of people that we've lost way too soon, another guy that we haven't really touched on, you talked about Michael and you made a reference to Buddy. I am absolutely compelled to ask you about your friend Bam Bam, Terry Gordy, a guy that, you know, got his start basically when he was 14 years old and was one of those guys who just from day one had this innate talent. Please share some thoughts and memories and maybe a story or two about Terry Bam Bam Gordy.
Yeah, I mean, he was phenomenal. And I also think that, you know, he became larger than life in real life and then went larger than life in mentally. And then I think that there was a downturn somewhere along the way. And I think, it may have happened on I think there was a trip to Japan where he may have had a little issue or something where drugs were kind of taken over. And then when he got back or something, it was he fell off the rope that I was talking about, and I believe that he just I think by then was he not divorced from Connie or separated from Connie as well, or was he still married to her? I don't know. I don't know that. I don't know that.
I'm not sure about that either, Jim.
But I think, you know, I mean, Terry and I and Michael, we all been around long enough to know that, damn, man, I mean, you know, somebody's got to throw up a stop sign somewhere, or we're going to kill ourselves, you know, or die or something. That's one of those things that, damn, he just didn't use obviously judgment or, you know, I mean, Tommy Rich was with him that night, I think, wasn't he? I think he partied with him on that particular night, if I'm not mistaken.
You're talking about
I don't know.
On the flight to Japan?
No.
Okay.
Or here the night that he died, the day that night.
Okay.
Yeah.
The Japan thing, I just threw that in because I think that, you know, he blacked out on the plane or, you know, there was some drug use thing going on or took too many pills or something like that. And he wasn't on his A game, you know. I don't know. That's a question, you know, that I don't know. Like, you know,
well,
you're asking me.
I know that before he had the incident on the plane that he was probably one of the maybe two or three best big men in the world at that time. And, you know, he was wrestling in a promotion that they had over there, what they call King's Road style, which was they worked super stiff and, you know, and he was working with guys like Hansen and Doc and, they worked that style it was like a hand to the glove, you know, and a guy that definitely could have been a world champion. And, you know, when he passed, he had been the UWF champion. And with my group of friends at the time, you know, we felt like our world champion had died. You know, that's how much we love Terry Gordy.
Yeah, well, you know, it doesn't need to be said how much we loved him and cared for him. And it was you know, just one of those things. You know, Michael and I talk about both the Buddy and Terry. In fact, I just sent some pictures to Michael last week, Buddy and Terry and Michael from Dallas, just as a reminder, because I was going through some old photos. But, you know, Terry was a great guy. You know, there's no doubt about that. I want to throw back on the one thing real quick, if I could. You were talking about World Class being really hot and everything and having the fans that they had. And the first thing that came to my mind, of course, just when you said that, and you're right, because they were. But I believe that if you took the Freebirds and the Von Erichs and me and Chris and Iceman and Buddy and that package that we had wrapped up, and put it in any territory, that it wouldn't take long for the fans to be dedicated, unbelievable fans, because they would be seeing an unbelievable product. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, and sure.
That makes sense to you?
Yeah, no, because that's how hot it was.
I mean, it was so hot. It just so happened. And this is my throw on it. It just so happened. It happened in Dallas, and of course the Von Erichs in Dallas, you know, that would obviously add a little fire, but, it happened in Dallas, but we could have took that team, that crew, you know, and went into any territory and popped it and got fans that you saw like in Dallas. Now, I do have to hand it to the Von Erichs because they are Texans and Texas is Texas. I mean, they're their own country, so to speak. and they love the Von Erichs. So, I mean, you know, would it be exactly the same if you took them to Kansas City? Well, you know, it might not be exactly the same, but you know what? It'd be daggum close, because the package when you went to the matches, and you seen Buddy and Iceman do their thing. And then you had such great underneath talent. We haven't even touched on that World Class had always had great underneath talent that was capable of doing anything almost. Now, not all of them, but a lot of them, including Rick Foley, who was just starting out in WCW. I mean, he was just cutting his teeth. And you know, I think he did pretty good for himself. But that you could have made super fans anywhere in the country with that package. It was like a package. It wasn't just wasn't one match. The main event isn't what the main event wasn't the only thing that drew, which is usually the case. They depend on the main event to draw. The main event could sell out. The match before the main event could have sold it out, and the match before that could have sold it out probably. You know, I mean, it was that kind of, it was just that intense with the people that were involved and the angles that we were doing. Mercer, remember the vignette where he came to my house?
Bill Mercer, I can't believe you came to my house.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Then we did one with Kamala. Remember, we did the one with Kamala. And of course, nobody had seen these vignettes. These vignettes weren't being done anywhere. But yet we would have one, you know, we started with mine and then we went and said, hey, this is not a bad idea. Let's do one on Kamala and then let's do one, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know,
no, they did the one with the Freebirds in the van at the drive-in where the car hop was coming in, you know, and he referenced something about the Asiatic Spike and Terry says, Bill Mercer, I don't, it appears you've been getting into my business. So yeah, all those were gold. There was no question about it, Jim.
Yeah. So that's just my throw on it. You know, I mean,
speaking of hot crowds, I wanted to ask you a hot crowd and a hot feud that a lot of people don't remember from the 80s that you were also a part of is when you and Ronnie went up to Montreal and you had a couple matches with the Rougeaus, and those crowds were pretty insane. Also, tell us what you remember about being in Montreal.
Oh, cripes almighty. I'll tell you what, Montreal was incredibly hot when you took the Ronnie and I against the Rougeaus, and then the dad, you know, kind of got involved, and then we left him laying in the ring I think we left all of them laying in the Forum, which was sold out. And then worked the return with I remember Barnett was involved on the return in the Montreal. I don't know how he got up there, but, you know, somebody, it seems like there was something going on with, I don't know if Barnett was up there or something, but you know, that's neither here nor there. Montreal was, you know, the Rougeaus were like the Von Erichs in Texas in Quebec. The Rougeaus were of some part of that caliber, that local hero type thing. And to come in there and to beat up the two boys and then, you know, beat up the father and leave him laying, that was huge. I mean, that was just, we took that all over Montreal. And then in fact, it was huge enough to where, Paul Catroni, who was the son of Paul Catroni Sr., who was the boss for the Montreal Mafia.
Wow!
And I'm not going to say much more about that because I don't want to get whacked. But
so can I interject you know, here? So this is, and this will be really interesting. And first off, Jimmy, we want to say thank you so much for joining us. We know that we've taken much more time than we originally allotted. I grew up with one of the sons of Catroni. His name was Nick Catroni. And it's a story that I will share off air with you because I don't want to get whacked either. At least
you do not want to break kayfabe on that story.
No, I definitely don't. But there's a great story because he used to tell us who his dad was. And, you know, we were kids who believed it until one day we started seeing all this research and holy shit, his dad really was the number one guy in the Montreal area. Unbelievable.
No doubt about it, because they would take us out at night into the clubs, me and Ronnie and Paul, the son. And, you know, in fact, Paul ended up getting whacked in his front house when he came out of the door with his attorney one morning, and they knocked him off, him and the attorney off in the yard. I think his dad was still in prison because he was, you know, doing some time. So Paul was taking charge of things, which, you know, leads into, you know, Montreal is a, you know, that's, you know, the Dino Bravo. There's a good example of not to bark up the wrong tree, you know, or try to, you know, hedge something on those boys, because they will find you and then they will make you disappear, you know. So I don't really talk about them too much, but they were alive and well when we were up there, and we would go in the nightclubs and they would be the step. We'd have, you know, the whole posse with us, and there'd be a corner already laid out in the whole place, and we'd dump out whatever they would dump out, whatever they wanted to dump out, and cut it right there in the table, and nobody said nothing. And I asked Paul one time, I said, what about the law? And he says, for me, he says, there is no law. And he, with the French accent, of course. And they were absolutely right too, because there was, I mean, we probably should quit talking about them.
Yeah. We don't want to break kayfabe anymore.
And it was free.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh,
well, good people though. Really salt of the earth people.
Yes. Enough. How much we like those people.
I love them. I think they go to church every Sunday and take care of old ladies, and they do great work. I'd hate to be without
community
them.
Community activists. That's
the
what
the Lord's
are.
Work. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, well, listen, Jim, I wanted to ask you next about your relationship with Ronnie Garvin. So how great was that, Barry? Was, I think, it's hard to believe, it was better than part one, I thought.
I have to agree with you, and I thought part one, look, that's taking you and I out of it, Jeff. The truth is, give Jimmy Garvin a microphone and just let him talk for 2 or 3 hours. The guy's unbelievable, and he has such a great recollection of his life and his career. But now I'm super pumped up and excited for part three coming up.
And in part three, we're going to discuss his relationship with, as I said at the end of that part two, we're going to discuss his relationship with Ronnie. We're going to talk about his run with Vern, the AWA, coming down to Crockett, and his angle with Wahoo, talking about the famous burning of Ronnie Garvin by the Midnight Express. That was great stuff. And then, you know, when he became officially a part of the Freebirds. So, but that's all to come in part three. And then, you know, if we get to it, we're going to talk about what he's been doing post-wrestling career, which is really fascinating, who he's been, dare I say, escorting to different parts of the world. I think you'll find that pretty interesting. So now, Barry, before we go, you know, as I mentioned this at the start of the show, you know, the whole storyline of the judge up in Kentucky that was wanting to have threesomes in the courthouse. And really, what judge doesn't want to have a threesome at the courthouse, Barry?
I look 100%. Yeah, we just discussed threesomes with Jimmy Garvin, too. What are the odds?
Well, you know, who knew? So so as I said, when I posted the article, Bruce Cohen said, Jeff, you got any good sex stories from the courthouse? Now, Barry, please let me specify here that there will be no names mentioned. As you can imagine, this is not something that he said, what about me coming out? So we're going to, as Jack Webb used to say, the names have been changed to protect the innocent. Okay. So I kind of reached out to some friends of mine, said, hey, you guys remember any good sex stories from the courthouse and or any stuff? And, you know, I was reminded of more than one or two. And the first one I thought of was that there was a very, very famous story that happened at the Broward County Courthouse, I want to say within the last 5 to 10 years. It involved a circuit court judge, which the circuit court judge, for those unaware, they're the judges that do the more serious cases, murders, felonies, you know, that kind of stuff, was in the middle of trial, Barry. She was texting with the prosecutor, and after the trial would take a break for the evening, she and the prosecutor were texting while he was at home and she was at home. That's a no-no. You know, that's not something that you should be doing. And apparently the texts were of a rather salacious nature. And so, she's been removed from the bench. She is no longer, matter of fact, I think she got her license, her bar license revoked. So unable to practice law. And the gentleman in question, he has been terminated from the state attorney's office. He's now a private attorney. That was quite the cause celeb there in Broward County for a while. There was also a scuttlebutt, Barry, certainly no verification that could be had of two judges that were carrying on and having an affair outside the bonds of their own personal matrimony at the court, whether it was at the courthouse, at the no-tell motel. So there were two judges that were getting it on. And then he apparently also was that particular judge right there was having an affair with one of the judicial assistants for another judge. The other judge found out about it, and what did he do? And he fired the judicial assistant, of course. God forbid he should go and confront the other judge. Hey, you're banging my secretary. Let's see what else we got. We have two attorneys that reportedly, during a break in a trial in the felony division, went into the stairwell, Barry. A little in flagrante delectico, if you know what I mean. How about that? Barry, you ever had sex in a stairwell?
Yeah, actually I have.
Well, look at you.
Yeah.
So, let's see. We had,
it's nice being young. Well, that's all I can say. Yeah. It hasn't happened lately, but yeah.
So then we had a girl that used to work for the clerk's office who is apparently quite the trollop. She went up to the top floor of the courthouse. And I believe, I don't know if it was with one of the court deputies or one of the, it might've been one of the IT guys, because that's where they had the IT division. And, in the bathroom, which, yeah, it's always classy. Have it in the old public bathroom, you know, just getting nailed in the public bathroom. But the other thing I remember about this girl, she, and she's no longer with the clerk's office, thank God for that. She apparently asked one of the court bailiffs to pass and in custody her phone number, her own phone number, Barry. I give it to the guy that's over there in custody. He seems like a real nice guy. Right. What could possibly go wrong there? So let's see. Oh, yeah. Famous story at the old courthouse. There's this thing that's called Law Day. OK. And it's sort of like it's not like a legal holiday, but it's something that, you know, where the members of the Bar Association usually get together, you know, have the finger sandwiches and a mixed cocktail. So there was these two attorneys who I believe I know one of them is no longer with us. I'm not sure if the second one is, but they had an office that was right across the street from the courthouse. And a big parking lot around their office. And so they would have a law day party every single year. And they would invite, I mean, there would be like 400 or 500 people that would show up. Okay. So in their office building, which was like, basically it looked like about the size of a cottage, there was one bathroom. Okay. So imagine this bathroom having to accommodate every single person that was at this party who felt the need to use the facilities. Okay. Well, apparently at one point, somebody went and the bathroom was locked. So they knocked on the door. Hey, I got to use the facilities here. Let's go. And then no one answered. They opened the door, at which time, a young female attorney who worked for the state attorney's office at the time was offering some, let's just say, gratification of an oral nature to a private attorney, which you certainly don't want to do that if you're going to do that. The really amazing thing is that private attorney that she was getting the gratification to ended up getting appointed as a judge some 20 years later. I always thought that was kind of funny. So then let me close out with this story, Barry, and tell me how awful that you can imagine this. So there was this woman who was an attorney at the courthouse. She's moved up north and is not in Broward County anymore. So she was working for a time with the public defender's office, and she was known to have she may have dated a few guys. Let's say that. OK. And there was one particular guy that she was in a relationship with for a couple years. They thought there was going to be marriage, but the guy was very, oh, no, 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 I don't want to do that. Don't want to do that. So she ends up marrying another private attorney. Okay. The relationship ends. She's marrying a private attorney. And so her husband that she's now married to has been known to be a bit of a shit stirrer. Okay. Like a young Barry Rose, not now, of course. But so this this young attorney that's a shitstorm occasionally grinds the gears of some of the local members of the defense bar. OK, so we had a cafeteria there in the courthouse, and a lot of times people would go and they get a cup of coffee, sit down. And, you know, like anybody else in any other job, they'd kind of shoot the shit about, oh, you got any good cases lately? So there was a table, four or five attorneys sitting there talking about the comings and goings of the courthouse. OK, so here, Mr. New husband comes over and, he starts stirring some shit up about something, and he really annoys one of the attorneys sitting at the table. OK. So the guy says, I'll pretend. Let's see. Let's pretend the newly married guy's name is Fred, and the guy she used to date's name was Bill. OK. So this attorney sitting at the table says to Fred, hey, Fred, let me ask you something. When you fuck your wife, do you get the taste of Bill's dick in your mouth?
Wow.
Oh, yes. Yes. That was not a nice thing to say, as you can imagine. I'm trying to think. I have one other story written down, and I can't remember what the reference point was.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, so yeah, those are just a few. I have to tell you, one of the things that I thought was really funny was when I ask a few people, they'd say, oh, you mean like such and such, you know, and everybody has a, you know, recently I called a friend of mine that still works for the clerk's office, and she said, oh, you want to hear some gossip? And she told me a story about just within the last couple of months that some guy that was a supervisor with my former office that may have been caught in the bathroom, apparently quite the romantic spot in the old courthouse, Barry.
See, and that's funny. Like, so, and I was going to ask you, and Lou, you can chime in or not. Like, what is the strain? And when I was younger, look, if an opportunity presented itself, I was probably going to jump on that regardless of the location. But a bathroom where there's the relieving of, urine and fecal matter, not really the most romantic spot. I did it in a stairwell, but in my defense, I grew up in a building that had two stairwells. I grew up in a condominium on Miami Beach, and it had two stairwells on either side of each floor. And the truth was, the stairwell, I think, is where every kid who grew up in that building probably had their first sexual encounter, would be my guess. I know I wasn't the only one. So what's the strange place that either of you guys have ever had some sort of
romantic sort of interlude
encounter?
Romantic,
yeah, interlude? What did you call it earlier? And Lou actually commented on it. Of course, Lou said trollop. Okay, well, yeah, so if you got trollop, which is a great word, Lou, what was the first place you guys ever, with the weirdest place that you guys ever had an encounter at, or the oddest place?
I have my answer, Lou. Would you like to offer yours first?
Lordy.
Go ahead. Break kayfabe, Mr. Kippelman. Your audience awaits your response.
Nobody's going to hear it, Lou. You'll be fine.
Right, exactly. Yeah. This is just, yeah.
This won't live on forever. Yeah, you'll be fine.
Yeah, me and a few degenerates with long memories. I don't know. I'm not exactly unconventional in that regard. I could say maybe I got frisky.
First time the word frisky has been used on this show too.
Yeah.
Yes. A shopping mall parking lot. That was
nice.
I mean, it wasn't, it wasn't anything too strenuous or athletic, but, good things happened.
So I will say, I'll give you two options, Barry. You can choose either my, night of romance, on the driving range at a golf course.
Nice.
Or, and this is a reference only Barry will get, the parking lot of Dan Dowd's. Remember Dan Dowd's that had the giant cow out in front?
Right. Yeah, sure do. Wow.
That was good times. Good times. You know, as Zep said, good times, bad times, you know.
But, I will tell you the strangest place I think I ever did. This is all going back to, I think by 90. Well, let me take it back. By 95, I think I was done with strange places because 95, 94, I think it was 94. I take that back. No, it was 95. It was 94 and 95. I was in the basement of a restaurant, a restaurant I was managing in New York City.
Was it Tavern on the Greenberry?
It was not. It was a place called Mulholland Drive Cafe where Patrick Swayze was one of the owners. So I was down there doing that. But I think the strangest place, and when I say strange, maybe the riskiest was the monorail at Disney World. I did. Yeah. In the 80s. 80s were completely different. That's, again, the beauty of being old was having been able to live through the 80s. Yeah.
The monorail, let's just say I began the evening on the monorail. Didn't finish the evening on the monorail, if you know what I'm talking about, and I think you did.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So, but yeah. So sex, three ways in the old courthouse. I have not heard about any threesomes in the courthouse I used to work at. But apparently in Kentucky, it's something the judges is looking forward to. So anyway, that's about it this week, gentlemen. I can tell you folks, part three of our interview with gorgeous Jimmy Garvin coming up next week. Barry, let's just say it. Jim Garvin has been one of the best interviews we've done a lot of interviews, but his has been really, really good stuff.
He has. And is the bar set so high now, Jeff, that, you know, going forward, it's all going to be a letdown in some form?
Because this means that Bob Roop, if he comes back on, is going to have to step up his game. That's all I'm going to say.
Right? Bob, you got to tighten that shit up. Absolutely. So
we're going to need to hear some better stories from Bob, you know, like maybe exactly. Some rat stories or something like that.
There you go. I'm sending out a text right now, Jeff.
So. Exactly. So anyway. So, gentlemen, yeah. I appreciate your time. And folks, until next week, Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For my co-host, Barry Rose, and for our producer, the sweet man out in the Bay Area, sweet Lou Kippelman, out there in the parking lot of a shopping center. Oops, I said it again. Now someone's going to remember Lou. That. I apologize, Lou. So until next week, we will talk to you later, folks. Have a good one.